Thank you, Pam. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals in a virtual manner and setting for May 27. I will first ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Riley, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And thank you. And we have this first matter, file A210058. It's the first of two oral proceedings, and we have two non-oral proceedings on this panel's calendar today for May 27, Pilot Air Freight LLC Respondent versus Adam Trenberth et al. As the who are the appellants. And counsel, I'm sure you're familiar, and everything is pretty much the same, though we're all in different locations, but you'll see the clock in the corner, and hopefully you continue to see that. If at any time we have any technological conflicts, we'll stop the clock and make sure we resurrect our connection with you. We do ask that when you begin your comments that you do state your name for our record. And I'll note for any participants that any separate recording in any way is prohibited by judicial branch rules. However, the audio version of the argument will be available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. And so with that, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Nick Sperling. I represent appellants Adam Trenberth and Anderson Cargo Services, LLC, in this appeal. Appellants request the court reverse the district court's amended order, granting a temporary injunction against appellants in its entirety, and remand this case for posting of an appropriate bond. There's a Minnesota case that I've seen cited a number of times in these non-compete TRO cases and cited in appellant's brief. I believe it's also cited in respondent's brief. It's Miller versus Foley. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1982. And that case is typically cited for the following quote, a temporary injunction is an extraordinary legal remedy, equitable remedy, excuse me. Appellants submit that this is the crux of why we're here today, to determine whether injunctive relief truly is an extraordinary equitable remedy or something that the courts can grant on a whim without due consideration for the law that's supposed to guide courts in making such a decision. Appellants submit that the former is the case, that courts must exercise some level of due diligence or at least follow the rules of civil procedure and binding Minnesota case law in granting this extraordinary relief. So appellants submit that the trial court committed reversible error here for multiple reasons, all of which are detailed in our briefing. But this morning, I'd like to focus on three specific areas. First, the trial court failed to specify the reasons for the injunction and improperly directed the parties to comply with the non-compete itself in violation of Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 65.04. Second, the trial court failed entirely to require or even mention the injunction bond required by Rule 65.03. Third, the trial court improvidently granted the injunction. It inferred irreparable harm to Pilot in a conclusory manner without supporting evidence, and it was based on distinguishable case law. It also misapplied the Dahlberg factors and ignored appellant's key defenses. So Those are kind of the focus areas that I'd like to focus on this morning. Starting with Rule 65.04, Rule 65.04 states that every order granting an injunction and every restraining order shall set forth the reasons for its issuance, shall be specific in terms, shall describe in reasonable detail and not by reference to the complaint or other document, the act or acts sought to be restrained. Now here,
Mr. Sperling, if we agree with you that the judge didn't comply with Rule 65 by setting forth those three specific things in her order, wouldn't we remand it for those findings? I was a little confused by your briefing exactly what you're requesting us to do. So are you requesting us to remand so that she can make proper findings?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very good question. And in the context of Rule 65.04, we're requesting a complete reversal of the amended order. In the context of Rule 65.03, as far as the injunction bond goes, we're requesting that the court remand to the trial court to set an appropriate bond.
So that leads me to my next question for both you and Mr. Norrie, and it has to do with mootness, because we're bumping up against the 1 year mark when it would go away, the injunction would go away. Could you speak to that, please, to the issue of mootness?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And, you know, first of all, my client would certainly appreciate it if the court would rule on this matter by July 2nd. But understanding that might not happen, that might not be the case, this appeal still matters, because after that, the court's order has significance in its implications for trial, for motion practice, or for settlement of this lawsuit, which is still very active. So the court's order on the injunction bond specifically, which I'll get to and describe in more detail shortly, has a great impact, because if the injunction is found to have been granted improvidently, my client may be entitled to collect against an injunction bond, and currently none exists.
So I was a district court judge, and I'm just, the time frame of this is so long, and I see that you requested a stay back in February. And at the time of briefing, I don't think that there had been an order on that. So what is going on procedurally?
That's correct, Your Honor. The trial court took the 90 days to rule on the motion to stay. It denied the motion to stay. So this is appellants, this is the only way that appellants can achieve a remedy here is by reversal and remand of the amended order.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Sperling, your answer to Judge Riley's question? So your point being, even if I understand correctly, the issue is moot, you would request a remand with regard to the bond issue, so that number one, the district court could reconsider a bond, or a bond different than the $25,000, as I understand it, that has been submitted, and then address whether it was improvidently granted in relation to your client's request for the bond, the damage, in other words, that he would argue has occurred. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor. Based on the court, the Court of Appeals opinion on whether this injunction was improvidently granted, I believe the trial court would be bound by that decision. And then we would make a motion to motion against the bond. And right now, I'd like to point out, Your Honor, that the $25,000 bond that was purportedly submitted by respondent in this matter was submitted after this appeal had been initiated. It was something like 2 weeks after this appeal had been initiated. So we don't believe that bond has been accepted by the trial court. It certainly doesn't do anything to fix the amended order, the absence of the bond in the amended order. We're requesting remand on that point to address the bond and to address it with an appropriate bond. Something in the lines of, my client's 1 year of my client's salary or something like that.
So if I could jump in briefly on this issue of mootness, as we're calling it. The language, I believe, from the case law is whether or not the temporary injunction was wrongfully, or whether the respondent in this case, or appellant in this case, that was wrongfully enjoined. The question, you put it improvidently. The question I have is, the way I understand that is that we would not consider compliance with, for example, 65.04 as we determine whether the injunction was wrongfully granted or improvidently granted. Do you agree with that? That you exclude some of the more technical or procedural aspects and you focus on something else, or is that part of what makes an injunction wrongful?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would argue that that absolutely is part of what makes the injunction wrongful here. The failure to comply with Rule 65.04 is not just a technical defect of the amended order. It's pervasive in the amended order, and it makes the amended order ambiguous, internally inconsistent. It the amended order is does not describe in reasonable detail the acts sought to be restrained. And even if it was clear in its terms, it directs the parties to comply with the non-compete itself. The reason why Rule 65.04 exists is it makes compliance with the amended order very difficult. When you can say that, you know, Trenberth can continue working, you know, possibly for Anderson, this is unclear in the amended order, in other capacities, but he can't violate the agreement, even though the agreement, the non-compete says he will not participate in any way for a competing business in the restricted area. So we believe that there's, you know, there's two components to how Rule 65.04 applies here. One is ambiguity. There's ambiguity in the amended order. And then the second part is inconsistency. And there's internal inconsistency in the amended order. So did I answer your question there, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you. In other words, putting aside the ambiguity or the inconsistency, the lack of a security or the lack of any order regarding an appropriate bond, you think that also is something we consider when deciding whether the injunction was wrongfully granted?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that it all fits together. You know, the amended order as a whole is flawed. And, you know, there are many different flaws. I think we pointed to 13 different flaws, you know, some of which are you know, admittedly, you know, very strong flaws, like the violation of Rule 65.04, which I think is, you know, very evident and obvious, the violation of Rule 65.03 as well. But we also have, you know, an argument based on case law that the injunction was improvidently granted, you know, based on a finding of irreparable harm. So that all ties together in the amended order.
So part of the issue on appeal is that we review these for abuse of discretion. And it's a short order. You say that it's not specific, it's internally inconsistent. And so why wouldn't we send it back for more specific findings so that we could apply our standard of review to it?
I think that's a good point, Your Honor. That's one of the questions that we asked, you know, early on in this case is, should we seek clarification from the district court in this matter? And the problem is the amended order is not just ambiguous, it's internally inconsistent. And we believe that makes it incapable of repair. We also awaited the trial court's ruling for 90 days. It issued an order without a memorandum. We waited another 15 days for the memorandum, and then that memorandum had an order. So we waited another day for an amended memorandum. Suffice it to say, we weren't confident that the trial court was going to, you know, give us due consideration, timely due consideration when it came to, you know, trying to repair the amended order. And we just thought it was too flawed to ask for that sort of relief. I'll get back into Rule 65.04 here, and just the rationale behind the rule of 65.04 is, you know, to provide a framework of clarity in issuing orders like this. So my client, you know, Mr. Trenberth, should not have to reference the language of his own non-compete to find out what he's allowed to do. And the court, by pointing to and referencing the non-compete and saying, as long as he doesn't violate the terms of his non-compete, that's as direct a violation of Rule 65.04 as possible. Moving into to Rule 65.03, I think it's plain to see here that the trial court failed to comply with Rule 65.03. It didn't mention a bond at all, an injunction bond at all. And so Rule 65.03 states, no temporary restraining order or temporary injunction shall be granted except upon the giving of security by the applicant in such sum as the court deems proper for the payment of such costs and damages as may be incurred or suffered by any party who's found to have been wrongfully enjoined or restrained. And that's exactly Sperling,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I wanted, before you leave the rule itself, I wanted to ask you an overall question. Would you agree, perhaps with the exception of the security that you were just talking about as required by Rule 65, that if a court properly analyzes all of the Dahlberg factors and hypothetically had addressed the security, would it not be so that necessarily Rule 65 has been complied with? In other words, we don't separately, I was looking at the way you frame the issues, and it seems to me, you look at the Dahlberg and all the cases since then, a temporary injunction must, the court must consider the Dahlberg factors, and then we know the security is an additional requirement by the rule. Am I stating that correctly, that if the Dahlberg factors are all properly analyzed, I realize you disagree with whether they were in the ultimate order, but if they are and security is addressed, then Rule 65 has been complied with as we would review it from an appellate standpoint.
I believe that's a large part of it, Your Honor, but I believe irreparable harm is also a hurdle that you would have to get over. And providing clarity around irreparable harm is something I'm going to get to in a moment here. So I would say that's a large part of it, but it's not all of it.
Because the rule of presuming the irreparable harm before you get to, so a temporary restraining order, one must show irreparable harm to get that. And then for the temporary injunction, you're presuming that carries over. Is that's the point you're making?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So
I'm sorry, I interrupted. If you want to finish your thoughts before I turn it over.
No problem. Thank you, Your Honor. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the underlying purpose of the injunction bond is to require the party seeking a temporary restraining order to pay for the harm caused by its erroneous granting. And the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has said, we allow the district court much discretion in setting a bond, but we will reverse its order if it abuses that discretion due to some improper purpose or otherwise fails to require an adequate bond or make necessary findings in support of its determinations. And that's the Hill versus Zyquad Eighth Circuit case. So there is precedent out there for reversal, or in this case, we're asking for remand on the basis of not addressing a bond or making necessary findings in support of determinations with a bond. Appellants asked this court to remand this case with instructions to order an appropriate bond on the Rule 65.03 issue. Moving into irreparable harm, because I think this will probably be a large part of where the argument is, or the disagreement between appellants and respondent.
And Mr. Sperling, I'll just remind you, we'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Your time did expire. So if you want to reserve that comment for your rebuttal time, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Norrie from the Bassford Remley firm, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the respondent, Pilot Freight Services. Mr. Trenberth's employment with Anderson Cargo violates the non-compete provision of his 2015 employment agreement, and that entitled Pilot to immediate injunctive relief to prevent irreparable harm. And today, we ask that the court affirm the TRO entered by the trial court in 2020. And apropos of some of the questions already, I think it's key that this court understand that the trial court has ruled on appellant's motion to stay, and they have the trial court denied that motion in its entirety. And that order, which was issued on May 10th, provides a lot of insight into the trial court's consideration of the motion, the underlying motion, and the reasons for its decision. And I think that's particularly important with respect to some of the questions that this court has already had regarding Rule 65.03. regarding the bond issue. And so I'd like to begin there and hopefully pick up on some of the questions that the court has. The first thing to note is that, as the trial court noted in its April 10th order, appellants did not argue the issue of a bond in the trial court below. They did not brief that issue. And the trial court deems that to be waived. And if it is waived in the lower court, it is waived in this court as well. So that's the first important consideration.
Well, part of the issue is that you filed your brief after that. Well, the reply brief came in on March 29th. So we don't have that order in front of us, which is why I asked if it had been ruled on.
Yep. So, and my understanding, Your Honor, would be that prior to the case being submitted for consideration, that the Court of Appeals has access to the entirety of the lower court record. So I think it's critical for this court to review the lower court record that, and I understand that it is somewhat unusual in terms of procedural posture for the district court record to continue to develop even after an appeal is filed. But again, here, this is an issue of the appellant's own making, right? This is not something that took place because Pilot did something. This is an order that exists specifically because the appellants took action. So all the more reason for the court to consider it.
Mr. Norrie, can I just clarify something you said about the bond and our review? It strikes me that this is a little bit different than this traditional scenario you're discussing where it not raised below, in the sense that Rule 6504 specifically obligates the court before issuance of this extraordinary remedy to consider bond. Wouldn't that, at a very minimum, whether it's ever raised, and if we agree the court did not consider it, to require a remand, perhaps not a reversal for the reasons we discussed or inquired? Can you respond to that, please?
Of course. I mean, this court is, of course, within its authority to consider what issues it determines are appropriate. But a couple of observations, Your Honor. The first is that if we read the trial court's May 10th order, it essentially tells us that it decided that it didn't need a bond. That's number one. Number two, it recognizes that my client has already filed a $25,000 bond. That's point number two. And point number three is there is no controlling Minnesota authority that even if the trial court made a mistake in not specifically addressing the issue of the bond, notwithstanding the fact that it wasn't raised, that the remedy for that would be a remand. And here, if this court were to remand it, if we read the trial court's May 10th order, it explicitly embraces the $25,000 bond that my client has already filed. So this court would be remanding to a trial court that has already said, I don't think we need a bond anyways. And even if we did, there's $25,000 bond that was already posted and that's just fine. So essentially remanding it at this point would achieve no purpose. And there is no controlling authority to reverse on the basis of a lack of addressing a bond that happens to now exist.
Other than the rule itself.
And except, Your Honor, that the rule itself does not itself note any authority for this court to reverse.
Right. Put the remedy issue aside. And I think if you're being careful, you're saying that there's no controlling authority regarding remedy. But that's how you said it at first. The way you wrapped up was saying there's no controlling authority, that there was error. And I think that the rule itself would be some controlling authority. Would you agree?
I do agree, Your Honor. And that was a misstatement on my part. I agree that the issue is controlling authority with respect to remedy. And the issue of remand here is complex because we know what the trial court is telling us.
The issue is even more complex because the May 10th order isn't in the record. We as appellate court judges can't look at what's going on in the district court, and we rely on the parties to make sure that the record is complete. So I don't know. The May 10th order is not in our record.
And Your Honor, I know that in our briefing, we submitted some authority with respect to this court's ability to consider matters that develop post-briefing. And I can't put my finger on the page for that right now, but I know it is in respondents' brief.
So the judge wrote, with regard to what the employee could do, acting in a matter inconsistent with his non-compete terms of his employment contract with Pilot. And I'm just not sure how that order complies with Rule 65.04. Because when I look at the non-compete, so for instance, you say that it's 150 miles from where he worked, but then you have these covered customers, and that seems like that would be the entire U.S. But I don't know what that exactly meant when she ordered that.
Sure. And Your Honor, certainly, number one, the court said that Mr. Trenberth could not serve as the vice president of sales. And I think it's really critical for the court here to understand that Mr. Trenberth has remained actively employed at Anderson Cargo through the entirety of this case. And so the claim that, oh, gee whiz, we have no idea what he can do, that's not accurate. He remains employed. That declaration was submitted by Mr. Trenberth where he swore as such. But it's important to take a look at paragraph 5E of the agreement. And the agreement says, look, you can't work for a competing business like Anderson Cargo if you have substantially the same function or responsibility, or if you're going to supervise somebody that had substantially the same function or responsibility, or if it involves the use or disclosure of confidential information. And so when the trial court is making reference to the agreement, it's making reference to these three elements. And I know that because that's what the trial court told us in the May 10th order. And so imagine a scenario in which, in its original 2020 order, the trial court had simply written those three categories, as I just described them from the order itself. There is no difference between the court referring someone to the actual agreement and the court simply repeating those provisions from the agreement. And so as a practical matter, there is simply no difference between referring to the agreement here and listing out those various parts in the order itself. I do agree it would be problematic if the court would have simply referred to a 60-page complaint without reference to what it was talking about. But here it was talking about what can you do and what can you not do. And we know that the appellant understood that well enough to continue being employed at Anderson Cargo. And my second point on all of this is, again, there is no authority with respect to remedy that notes that if the trial court did err in with respect to Rule 65.04, that is reversible error instead of something that simply should be remanded for additional explanation, as Judge Riley asked about earlier. And so, again, if this court were to issue such a remand, we already know what the trial court would say. And I understand Judge Riley's concern about whether or not that May 10th order is properly before this court. But when we remand, the trial court would be able to address that very issue if this court had a concern. With the remaining few minutes that I have, I want to move on to one other issue, and that is the issue of irreparable harm that I know that Mr. Sperling will touch on in his rebuttal time. And that's, of course, really the linchpin of any TRO decision, right? And again, as this court has observed, the lens through which this court must view that decision is one of abuse of discretion. But more than that, this court must take the facts as they are alleged in the affidavits. Yes, sir.
The question I have regards the part of irreparable harm that looks at the adequacy of legal remedies. It seems odd to say that we have to look at that through the lens of abuse of discretion. Or isn't this court capable of deciding what legal remedies may or may not be present? That's not really a factual determination. That's more of a legal question, is it not?
Well, certainly questions, even within the confines of a review of a TRO, questions of law are reviewed de novo. But I'm not sure that there's clear guidance in any of this court's prior decisions about how to split that. And I think so, the overarching concept.
There's a case, Medtronic v. Advanced Bionics Corp., that has been cited for the proposition that, quote, we reviewed de novo whether a party has an adequate remedy at law. So I think there is some authority to suggest that it's a de novo review, not abuse of discretion, for the purposes of adequate legal remedy. But why don't I lead you along to that precise question. Whether the district court conclude regarding what adequate or inadequate legal remedies were available.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't quite understand your question. If you could repeat it, the microphone was just a little buzzy.
Sorry. So I first quoted, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
I first quoted authority that says we review de novo, not abuse of discretion, the question of adequate legal remedy. And then my question for you was, what did the district court, how did the district court analyze the availability of an adequate legal remedy?
Of course. So we know from cases like Advanced by Medtronic versus Advanced Bionics that the issue of adequate legal remedy can touch on the loss of customers and the loss of confidential information. And in the court's order, it referenced both of those issues, the potential loss of customer information and the potential loss of customers and the potential loss of confidential information. And I do acknowledge that the trial court did not explicitly describe a finding with respect to adequate legal remedy, but it did specifically describe a finding with respect to the risk of a loss of confidential information. And that, of course, does lead to a conclusion that there is no adequate legal remedy, because once a party loses its confidential information, you can't fix that. And that's the Advanced Bionics decision. And we also know, again, from the court's May 10th order, when it does discuss this, that it concluded that the loss of confidential information is not something that can be fixed. And this really dovetails into the larger issue of irreparable harm, right? Because what this court focuses on is, you know, is it enough to simply allow a party to try and recover damages after the fact? And what this case really hinges on is customer goodwill, in addition to the loss of confidential information. And again, that is also the Advanced Bionics case, where it's clear in a long line of cases from this court and other Minnesota courts that you can infer irreparable harm when customer goodwill is at issue. When you're dealing with an employee, as we are here, who has obtained a personal hold on customer goodwill.
So Mr. Sperling said that we should remand so that the judge can consider bond, so that when they win at trial, they can go after the bond. So I'm just wondering procedurally, so is there going to be a trial?
Well, sure. I mean, there's still an underlying claim of breach of contract and tortious interference. It may end up that the claim against Mr. Trenberth, they may move that to arbitration. One or both parties may move that to arbitration, but the claim against Anderson will remain in district court. And so there will be proceedings with respect to either or both claims in which damages will be found eventually. And there is a bond posted. And if I could just finish making my final point with respect to irreparable harm.
Yes, you may finish your point, Mr. Norrie.
Thank you, Your Honor. So appellant argues that the St. Jude Carter case, St. Jude 2, kind of totally upends the analysis of irreparable harm. But it changes nothing with respect to this case. And because 3 points, the St. Jude Carter case specifically notes that there are circumstances in which it may be appropriate for a district court to infer irreparable harm, and it notes the issues present here, customer goodwill and confidential information. But the more important issue is that in the St. Jude case, the plaintiff there did not contend that customer goodwill was at stake. And that's because Mr. Carter wasn't a salesperson. So the holding in St. Jude doesn't change anything here, because it doesn't apply to this case involving a salesperson where customer goodwill is key. I thank the court for its attention.
Presiding Judge Sleater, may I just make an observation?
You may, yes.
So I have never been on an appellate panel where a party has cited an order that came out after briefing to support its argument that the judge didn't abuse her discretion. And neither, we didn't get any briefs on that. We don't know what the order says. I'm just commenting that it's a very unusual situation in my experience.
And perhaps after the rebuttal, I might comment about supplemental briefing with regard to mootness, and we might add, we might make reference to that. It would make some sense to allow counsel to add that to supplemental briefing as well. Thank you, Judge Riley. Mr. Sperling, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm glad we left off with irreparable harm, because I wanted to touch on some of the cases that respondent's attorney touched on here, Mr. Norrie touched on. First of all, the Medtronic versus Advanced Bionics case. This case, it's interesting. If you turn to page 451 of that opinion, of the Advanced Bionics opinion, you can see where the amended order started to take shape. The court borrowed a lot of language from Medtronic versus Advanced Bionics in its amended order. It also cited the Thermorama case, web publishing, and a number of other cases along that line. The problem is, in citing Advanced Bionics, Thermorama, and basing its decision on Advanced Bionics, those cases did not allege that their respective former employees might possibly solicit business from a former customer or divulge unspecified confidential information. There were real and concrete allegations of systematic or direct solicitation. Or in the case of Advanced Bionics, direct evidence that the former employee was going to go directly and use Medtronic's confidential information and trade secrets at his new job. So St. Jude Medical, too, we cite that for the proposition that the threatened injury must be real and substantial. And that's in St. Jude Medical, too, they're citing the AMF Pinspotters case. So no circumstances giving rise to an inference of irreparable harm were present here. There was only a bare allegation, a bare assertion that Trenberth would disclose Pilot's confidential information to Anderson, although Trenberth himself attested that he would refrain from doing so, and he'd refrain from contacting any of Pilot's customers. So the trial court did not require Pilot to establish that its confidential information or customer goodwill needed to be protected or was at stake here. So the analysis in St. Jude Medical 2, particularly on pages 684 and 685 of that opinion, are congruent with the facts to analyze this case. Just as in St. Jude Medical 2, Pilot's argument here of inevitable disclosure of confidential information is not supported by the facts. There's no evidence that Trenberth took Pilot's business secrets or confidential information, and Pilot only has a speculative fear of possible disclosure that's unsupported by the evidence, just as in St. Jude. So the Supreme Court said that, you know, based on these factors,
I didn't find St. Jude all that persuasive, because it involved capital EP versus disposable EP, and those are really different markets.
Thank you, Your Honor. And you know, I believe, you know, the St. Jude Medical 2, you know, it's more of an excerpt that I'm referring to here, and its reliance is more on AMF Pinspotters, that the harm alleged has to be concrete. And I think St. Jude Medical does a good job of analyzing that, but really it's a relying on the AMF Pinspotters case for that assertion. So any evidence that Trenberth had a hold on the goodwill of Pilot's customers has been squarely refuted by Trenberth. You know, Mr. Norrie said that, you know, in the St. Jude Medical case, they didn't contend that customer goodwill was at stake. Well, is it just that you have to contend that it's at stake, or do you have to prove that it's at stake, present some evidence that it's at stake? And that's what we think the distinction is here. I'd like to quickly respond to the Rule 65.03 argument here. You know, we filed this appeal on January 13th, 2021. And the bond was not addressed at that point. There was no bond filed. The court can't go back and accept a bond after the fact when the amended order was already had been appealed. So applying a bond in May, which, you know, the court didn't explicitly accept the bond, is inadequate. It's inadequate to protect a litigant who has an injunction filed against them. So we don't believe that the bond was appropriate. We don't think that there's a fix for the bond aside from remanding the case. And then we believe that the case should be reversed on the basis of irreparable harm, violation of Rule 65.04, and just the fact that Pilot has not presented any evidence that Trendworth has taken any customers, any goodwill or confidential information. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. And as you heard, we had a couple of questions early on about mootness, and we had not seen any reference to that in either party's brief. And so what we'd like to do is require supplemental briefing of the parties with regard to that issue. And then I, with the consent of my colleagues, I think I'll add the question that Judge Riley asked as well with regard to that May 10 order that was made reference to and the authority, if any, for our court to consider that in relation to the party's argument and our disposition. And so we will order that the parties e-file and e-serve supplemental memoranda with regard to the issue of mootness. And the questions then, I'll be issuing a written order on behalf of the panel with regard to this, but I'll give you a thumbnail idea. The first question is when, just to confirm, the parties agree the non-compete agreement and temporary injunction expire. I think the July 2 date appears to be the in agreement, but you could confirm that. And the next question is, will expiration of the non-compete agreement and temporary injunction render this appeal moot? And third, if the answer to that question is yes, should this appeal be dismissed, or will an exception to the mootness doctrine apply? And then I would add on behalf of the panel, the final question as well, related to the issue that Judge Riley raised, and whether what authority is there for us to consider. And I believe in this case, it's the May 10 order that's not part of the record in our consideration of the issues. Did either counsel have any questions? And I will be issuing a written order, so you'll see that as well.
No questions here, Your Honor.
Two questions, Your Honor. One, I just want to be sure I understand correctly that all of the questions that the parties are to address in the supplemental briefing, those questions will be included in the court's written order to follow.
Correct. That's correct.
And is the court able to give the parties any sense right now of when it would like to receive that briefing and in what order?
Yes, I'm sorry. Our thought is to limit it to a 10-page briefing. The appellant's brief would be due June 3, and the respondent's brief the week following. I believe that's June 10. Does that sound correct? I believe that's correct. And we'll make sure to include that in the order as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. And thank you to both counsel. We do appreciate your briefing and the answers to our questions today. And we will, of course, wait to take the matter under advisement upon a review of the supplemental briefing. And then we will do so at that point.